Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. And here's where I interview authors about their latest novels. My guest today is Julie Anderson, author of the Whitehall trilogy and the book we're going to be discussing today, The Midnight Man, which is the first in the Clapham trilogy, set in the winter of 1946, when a young nurse goes missing. Two women from the South London Hospital for Women and Children join up to investigate the mystery. It's an intriguing time, and Anderson obviously loves this part of London and its history, as you'll undoubtedly pick up from our chat. So here's Julie Anderson. Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM, Julie.
Hello there. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. New novel, new publisher. Exciting times, is this?
Well, yes, absolutely. And I suppose it's particularly exciting because I started out, when I started writing, I wrote historical novels for young adults, specifically mm-hmm. for my nephew and godson. And so historical novel writing was where I started out. And I guess this is sort of going back to it. It's going back to a first love, really. I've had a wonderful time writing the sort of contemporary Whitehall thrillers, especially given that it's a world about which I know quite a lot, having inhabited it for a while. but this is going back to what I instinctively did when I started out. So, yeah, it is exciting and I'm enjoying it.
You worked, and you mentioned this actually, this knowledge of Whitehall. Well, it comes from, of course, the fact that you were a civil servant, a senior civil servant for very many years. Mm. I wonder, actually, that probably didn't leave you a lot of time for writing. So when did the writing come in, you know? Was it sort of always something you wanted to do?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, I remember writing my first book when I was about 10.
Right.
And it was a horribly derivative school story that was a mixture of Enid Blyton and Angela Brazil, I think. I mean, it was appalling. Right. And I remember my English teacher religiously reading it, and the woman had so much patience and you know, encouraging me and so on, and it was appallingly bad, and I'm glad that it has gone the way of all flesh, but I think I've always wanted to do that. I taught English for a while, and I taught creative writing for a while. Mm-hmm. As a sort of second best option, and then joined the civil service and was a career civil servant. Mm-hmm. And of course writing played quite a big part in that, because I was writing all the time, writing
reports, of course.
Writing press releases, etc., or overseeing other people writing press releases. There are one or two journalists who will remember me back then, who would say that I was writing fiction even in those days. but yeah, I mean, you know, the writing skills writing skills are something that's very important to civil servants.
So. I mean, I could make a comment about government getting even more fictional as we go along, but let's
absolutely
leave it there, shall we? No, it's interesting you say that. I think there's a couple of things. One is it's really interesting, I think, that you need a kind of hinterland, and you also need an experience. You know, when you start writing, you do need that, don't you? So having that career in Whitehall is pretty important in being formative in how you write, isn't it?
It is. And it was something, I mean, language is is a tool that can be used for many purposes, and you learn quite a lot of those when you're working in Whitehall. So language to communicate, language used to communicate, language used to obfuscate, language used to elide two completely different topics together. Mm. The sort of niceties of felicities or infelicities of language, something right. that you deal with all the time at that sort of level, especially, of course, when you're dealing with ministers who have their own agenda.
Indeed. What about then? How different was it then writing fiction when you actually came to sit down to write fiction? What was that like?
Well, quite releasing in many ways, because, I mean, essentially, I started out by writing historical fiction. So I built my own framework within which I had to operate.
Right.
It was in 13th century Spain.
Yes, right.
Nothing easy there. Within that sort of set of constraints, I was able to do what I wanted. And so it was actually very liberating. You know, one's imagination was the source of everything that I wrote and still have written. Although invariably you draw in things that your own experience and experience that you've seen from others or others have enjoyed, and real things happening. So it becomes a sort of mashup of your imagination, your experience. That hinterland of which you spoke, and what you see going on around you. But initially, I found it very liberating because I wasn't constantly having to think about, you know, what the papers would make of it,
right? Yeah,
or whether the minister wouldn't want that reference to another piece of policy, or yes, you know, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, everything would have a consequence. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, the only consequence that my my writing would have had at that stage would have been bad writing, you know, and losing people from the story, which is, you know, horrible and anathema, and I don't want to do it. But it's not quite the same as an external force.
No, it's not. Right. I mean, you have to take a chance there, and you jump off a ledge, don't you? And, you know, you don't know whether you're. You don't know how it will be received, but obviously it has been received well. So that's why we're here chatting about your writing. I suppose, in a way, there's plenty of intrigue in Whitehall as well. That must back you up a little bit.
Yes. That's all I can say, really. Yes, there is. I mean, there's an awful lot of intrigue even within the civil service. They say, you know, Whitehall is a village, and it is. Everyone knows everything else. Everyone knows or likes to think they know of the pecking order of everyone else and where people are moving to and whether they're going to take so-and-so with them and what their next move might be. And it's the worst place for gossip, which I never really, I'm not a good gossip because I'm
right.
I love getting information, but I don't particularly like sharing.
Not good at sharing.
No. it's hugely gossipy, and there's an awful lot of intrigue about, you know, people manoeuvring and positioning themselves. It's a highly competitive environment, you know.
Yes, of course.
That is simply what happens under those sort of circumstances. But you're not running a race or playing a game or whatever. You're all sat behind your desks, or not, as the case may be these days. You know, there's an awful lot of machinations goes on.
No, I can imagine.
Between what are predominantly sedentary people.
That's a good way to put it. But, I was almost tempted to say, well, now you've retired. But, of course, you haven't retired. What you've become is a full-time writer.
Yeah.
And there's a lot on in that as well, because I think, well, let's start with something. You're involved heavily with the Clapham Book Festival. So tell us a little bit about that, please.
Well, that was something that started back in 2016 was our very first one. I live in Clapham in South London. One of the things when I started writing that I learnt about my immediate locale was that lots and lots of other writers live here too.
Right.
And I, you know, we just kept bumping into each other at events. And so we sort of said, well, why don't we, do something together? Mm. What that gave rise to was the Clapham Book Festival. I was one of the co-founders along with Elizabeth Buchan, John Taylor, who's a military historian. And later on, we acquired other writers along the way. We had our first festival in 2016, and we've had one aside from 2020,
yes, right,
COVID year, ever since. Actually, as part of my research into doing the Clapham Literary Walk, which I do as part of the festival, I discovered just how many writers have lived in Clapham, and it's astonishing. Right. Really astonishing. I mean, the first Clapham writer, if one can term him that, was a guy called Edward Winslow, who sailed on the Mayflower. He became second governor of Virginia, and he sent manuscripts back across the pond to be published in London. Sort of home thoughts from abroad, if you know what I mean. And he's the earliest Clapham writer I've been able to track down in terms of publishing
things. Yes, right.
But I mean, we've had lots and lots and lots since. Just digressing slightly, Clapham currently has, or Lambeth, I suppose, but Clapham has a bit of a reputation as, you know, the People's Republic of Lambeth.
Yeah, right.
Rather like the People's Republic of Sheffield some years ago, as being a sort of left-wing and archetypical of that sort of metropolitan elite, much despised by those on the right wing, or more towards the right wing of today's society. But I also discovered it was ever thus. Lots and lots of writers who lived in Clapham.
Interesting, isn't it?
Managed to ruffle feathers in a major way. I mean, the Times, the newspaper, the Times was founded in Clapham. But that's an example. Another is in the early 18th century, the censor for the king actually described Clapham as a Whig warren because there were so many Whig or anti-Tory independent presses. And by that, I mean literally iron presses that were turning out pamphlets and so on. It was quite interesting to discover all that literary history of the place where I live.
That really is interesting. I never realised that. I sort of assumed that, you know, almost any community you could pick in London, you could, you know, you throw a hat over the writers because of the nature of London, the way it is. But that is interesting, the radical aspect. I hadn't known that. It's fascinating when you dig in and you find that, yeah.
It is. I mean, it was interesting. We had that very first Clapham Book Festival. There was a session called The Sense of Place. I chaired Elizabeth Buchan and Dr. Matthew Beaumont, who is now a professor at University College, I think, who was born and bred in Clapham, about Clapham and its history with radicalism and writers. And why it attracted so many radical writers over the years. And, of course, one has to remember that it wasn't part of London for a lot of time.
Yes, of course, right.
It was outside London, but with easy reach. I think we came to the conclusion anyway that it was to do with the fact that it was a place that was based around common land. So you had this open space, this liminal area.
Right.
Where people could walk and think and you know, you were outside the confines of...
So it sort of created its own sense of freedom.
Absolutely, and it is interesting. Benjamin Franklin stayed here, did his experiments with lightning on the common in one of the
parks.
But you know, you've got all this history and it's sort of there. And you know, you look at Holy Trinity Clapham, which is the rather wonderful 18th century church on the common, which is the anti-slavery church, which is where Wilberforce and all the others worshipped, which is a bit daunting to anybody who lives in Clapham now, because, you know, as you know, that, you know, people up the road did something like that.
I don't think you can imagine. What you can't get a sense of, I suppose, in a way, is the radicalism of just those ideas, because it was fighting against the whole system, and the whole system was, of course, geared entirely the opposite way. Yeah. But it does give you something really interesting to hang the festival on, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's a new festival, yeah. But at the same time, it has this tradition, is something you can marry to it, which is really fascinating, yeah.
And we do try and reflect that in the programming as well.
Yeah. Oh, a little bit more on your own writing and that, separate to the novels. But just, you do reviews for magazines and you write websites and things. Tell us a little bit about that too, please.
Well, I currently write a quarterly column for Time and Leisure magazine,
where I
review books. Actually came out of the book festival because they became first of all, we sought publicity from them. They're a local South London magazine, and they carried an article about us, which I wrote, and subsequently they've become our media partners in that they provide all the technical support for our online interviews with as part of that, I found myself writing more and more for them. And of the four columns I write, one of them is invariably about the Clapham Book Festival that happens in the autumn. But the other three are about books, usually, but not exclusively, crime books. And I've become a sort of roving reporter. I spent a Wednesday a couple of weeks ago at the top of one of the chimneys of Battersea Power Station.
All right.
reporting for Time and Leisure on something that the Power Station were doing, which is called Book Nook in the Sky. One of those huge, huge chimneys has been converted.
It's always one of those things that's fascinating when you go to London, now that it's been done. But of course, I mean, remember for 20 odd years, you know, there was just an article in the evening papers every day saying, you know, what are they going to do with what are they going to do with Battersea Power Station?
Absolutely.
But yeah, it must have been brilliant to be up there though.
It was terrific actually. Because the whole of the chimney, the centre of the chimney, is the lift. And you sort of go up and all you can see is the disc of sky above you.
Right.
Usually, blue in the day, but in my case, sort of dirty black because it was night. And you sort of go up there and then you sort of pop out at the top. And the sides and the roof of the lift are glass. So you suddenly have this 360-degree view of London from something like 110 meters up.
We're used to views looking south, but we're not so used to views looking north, are we, getting that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. It was terrific. I did enjoy it. And we talked about books for three quarters of an hour. And books set in London and set in the places one can see from the top of the chimney. But that was my latest foray for Time and Leisure. I've become a sort of roving reporter. If they've got someone to talk, they want to talk about books, or attend book events or whatever, I get sent along.
Honestly, that sounds great.
It is like
a perfect job.
It is.
Mentioned, of course, that a lot of your writing is about crime fiction. So why was it crime for you then?
It didn't start out that way. As I said, I started writing these sort of historical adventure stories.
Right.
Essentially for my young relative, and then published them and so on.
But you knew you were going to publish at that time, did you? It wasn't just about the family.
No, I knew I was going to publish at the time. The first of them, which was called Reconquista, was long-listed for the Miss Lexia Children's Award of 2016. And that brought me to the attention of a publisher who came, you know, I arranged to meet. And they said, well, look, you know, are you going to carry on writing this niche stuff, in effect? or are you going to write something that's commercially viable? And I sort of said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, what about crime fiction? Everything that you know, you're writing about in your adventure stories, you know, there's danger, there's jeopardy, there's betrayal, there's all sorts of that sort of thing. You can write about in the context of a crime book.
Yes.
I laughed at them and said, no. And then I had had to have an operation. And I knew that I'd be laid up for about 3 months. And so I was just lying there thinking, what can I do? And
so you had the time.
Maybe I'll have a go. And that's how I started writing crime. And that was the start of the book, which subsequently became Plague, and which that publisher published about a year and a half later.
Oh, right. Well, they knew what they were doing then, didn't they? That's curious, because I'm not sure I make a distinction, honestly, with historical fiction and crime fiction. It, you know, with the exploration of as you said, you've got so much intrigue and you've got so many things going on that I don't worry about any sort of lines between. I mean, you picked Andalusia in the 13th century.
Yeah.
So you've got Moorish Spain, you know. I mean, it's a fascinating time period, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And indeed, we have a home in Spain, in Andalusia.
Right.
So when one is there, it's impossible to ignore that wonderful mixed background and history that is there. The buildings are still there. Many of them have been repurposed, the Arab buildings into the mosques have been turned into
churches. Yes, of course, right.
But, you know, you still have, it's in the food, it's in the language, it's in the music, because flamenco music is... owes an awful lot to Arab music, and you only need to listen to modern flamenco singers to recognise, you know, the call to prayer is in there. You know, that wonderful, wonderful lilting call, that use of notes, it's still in the music today. So it's not a dead thing; it's a living and vibrant mixture of different cultures.
Yes,
and that's what attracted me to writing about the history of it.
Yeah, and of course, for hundreds of years, they did get on together and the cultures did mix quite a lot. But unfortunately, times came and things changed. The interesting thing is for you, of course, this gives you a chance to, well, I suppose, live two of your loves. One is travel and one is history, isn't it? So you get to write about them as well. It's a triple whammy, I suppose, if you like.
Well, it is. Actually, you make my life sound amazing, Paul. You really do.
Well, I'm in rainy Wales right now, so I'm kind of feeling sorry for myself, probably.
Well, I'm in rainy London.
Okay, good. I feel better now.
No.
But, yeah, well, let's talk then about, because then by 2020, as you said, you were then taken on by this new publisher, and that's when we get the Whitehall series.
Yeah.
So this is where you get to write a little bit about what you know and add all that imagination and world building and so on of your own in there. But there's three novels. There's Plague, Oracle, and Opera. And Opera was CWA longlisted, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, it was, for the Ian Fleming, The Steel Dagger, in 2023. So, yes, something of which I am inordinately proud.
Absolutely. Mainly because,
it was amazing. And I was the, or my book was the only book on that long list that wasn't published by one of the big funds or their imprints, the only one that was published by an independent. So I'm even prouder of that in a way.
Yes, I see what you mean. It's an interesting validation. You don't need a validation. You don't need to be, but it's great to know that your peers in that sense read your books and they think they're worthy of note.
Absolutely. And I absolutely disagree. I need as much validation as I can get. and I'm sure that you have spoken to lots and lots of writers who say exactly the same thing.
Yes. I was trying not to imply anything there. Again, I mean, one of the things, but tell us a little bit about the Cassandra Fortune series then, please. Let's start there.
Okay. Well, essentially, I suppose in the three books, what I tried to do was explore how Whitehall works, how it can be manipulated, and how it can be used to the detriment of Parliament and to the country. And also, I guess I wanted to talk about things that I knew about that lots of people don't know about, simply because, you know, I was privileged enough to work in Whitehall for a long time. And I'm a history geek, so I learned a lot of things. But somewhere like the Palace of Westminster, for example, is just a fascinating building. It shouldn't, in my humble opinion, be the centre of the legislature anymore. Let us have a modern building for that.
Right, and make it a museum.
Yeah, because it is absolutely fascinating. Mm. Alongside the sort of the bricks and mortar and the history and the stories, you've got all sorts of weird anomalies that still exist. And I mean, Plague is an example of talking about one of those, in that you have the fact that the law of the land does not apply within the chamber of the House of Commons.
Yes, right.
Now, the most visible example of that is what's called parliamentary privilege, is the ability for MPs to stand up and name alleged perpetrators of crimes without fear of being pursued for libel. It's a privilege which is used sparingly because MPs know that they can't misuse it. But it has been used, and to great effect, in the past. So someone stood up and condemned Robert Maxwell, if you can remember.
Yes.
Him, late and unlamented proprietor of, I think it was the Daily Express at the time, or the Mirror.
Mirror.
I can't remember. Mirror, thank you. Your memory is better than mine. But you know, he was a notoriously litigious press magnate who, it subsequently was found, had actually stolen money from his own employees' pension fund,
yeah.
I think it was Dennis Skinner who stood up in the House on that occasion and called him out. And of course, there was nothing that Maxwell could do about it in terms of going to law, because under parliamentary
privilege, yes, of course,
Skinner could say whatever he wanted. So that's the most obvious and visible example. Yeah.
But yeah. So you've got all that history, but also you mentioned there something else about sort of discovering London as well, because London is built on top of London, and it's built on top of. And so you've got all these centuries of things to look back on. And that's something you're very interested in, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, my husband keeps telling me that actually I ought to set my novels above ground rather than below. I mean, Plague was involved the the underground course of the Lost River Tyburn and various sewerizations of it, and Basil Jett's wonderful, wonderful sewer system. I wax lyrical when I talk about Basil Jett.
Well, you know what? I think, well, it is fascinating. I mean, it's a remarkable scheme that was filled in. The way that, you know, it's the side of the Thames by Somerset House, for instance, is a lot narrower now because, of course, that's where the sewer was put in. And I think one of the things that struck me about it as well is, if I remember rightly, two people died in the production of the whole of the sewer system under Basil Jett. Mm. And when you consider what they do now with modern building projects, like something where, you know, in the Middle East where they decided to build the stadiums for the football.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have those standards. So he must have had a tremendous standard of care at that time as well for his workers.
I think so. I think he's a bit of a hero of mine because he did take care of his workers. But he also had enormous foresight. I mean, when he was designing his sewer system, he calculated everything on things like population, water flow, you know, cubic capacity and so on, and then sat down and doubled it all.
Right.
On the basis that London was only going to grow. And so he in effect future-proofed.
Yes.
Sewerage system. And I mean, until the building of the sewer, the super sewer, at the start of this century, it was doing okay, because he'd future-proofed it to that degree. And that was someone sitting down in the 1880s working all this out. You know, 150 years later, we're still using most of it.
That's very true. I mean, if you think about it, nobody ever built a motorway in the 20th century and said, we'll build it a bit bigger than we were intending to for the traffic we've got now, because in the future there'll be more traffic. But of course, he had that kind of foresight.
Yeah.
What about then? I mean, you wrote three novels in the series. Are you going to go back to that series, or is that the series done now?
I think I might do. A lot of people ask me that question, mainly because the third of them ended on something of a cliffhanger.
Yes.
Which I won't mention.
No.
I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't read the book. And I had always intended to write a fourth. And indeed got so far as to sort of map it out, and then essentially got seduced by going back to write historical fiction. And that's ultimately what I did. But I would at some point like to go back and do a Cassie number four, just so that people and actually quite a lot of readers like her. Well, or they're engaged by her. Some of them don't like her at all, but they are engaged by her and they want to know what happens. So I sort of think I have to at some point.
Right. So we'll leave them with that little element of hope there about the future. Good point then. You did talk about the Midnight Man, or you hinted at it there. Let's talk about the Midnight Man. Tell us a little bit about the sort of scenario then. Let's set that up first of all, please, Julie.
Okay. Well, this book is set in South London, in Clapham, where I live, in 1946, so immediately post-war. And it's the winter of 1946-47 was the then, at the time, the coldest winter since records began. So and post-war, once the euphoria of VE and VJ Day had worn away, post-war Britain was a grim and austere place. Mm. Most of the wartime rationing continued. Some of it increased. Bread was never rationed during the war, but it was immediately post-war.
That's interesting, right?
There was strict restrictions still in place, wartime restrictions in effect, on most of the population. So you couldn't change a job, for example, without permission. I mean, I heard about that from my own mother, actually.
Right.
Who
she was your inside source on this period.
It was something that that she'd mentioned to me years ago, actually, that sort of stuck in my mind, because she had been during the war. She was a young woman, a very young woman, a teenager, but she'd been working for a tailor, he'd been turning out uniforms for the forces, and. It was something, she taught me to sew, which was a good thing. But aside from that, she wanted to move and work elsewhere. And she did. And essentially, she was told that she was going to be fined And that's what happened if you tried to move jobs without getting permission. Labour restrictions were very, very tight, as were restrictions on materials. So if people recall those sort of black and white films of the 50s and indeed the 60s, you still have bomb sites, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Way into the 60s, yes.
Absolutely. And but that's in part because for most of the 40s and 50s, the materials were in short supply, and indeed they were the use of them was restricted, certainly into the early 50s. You couldn't simply go along and buy something in order to build.
No, I suppose it makes sense. It's sort of a planning system, isn't it? It's a central planning system. So you know where, you know, what you need for tailoring, what you need for wood and, you know, the timber industry and so on. And of course, rationing itself didn't end until, what, the mid-50s.
That's right. That's right. So it was a grim place. But I wanted to write, I mean, essentially what I wanted to do, I wanted to write about contemporary things through writing about the past. And one of the things I sort of wanted to write about was a period that was very like the one that we've just had and are still going through. So post-COVID, if you like, post-pandemic. But I didn't want to write about COVID. And it seemed to me that the closest parallel to our situation, when we just sort of emerged from a global cataclysm, which was very deadly.
Yes, you know, yeah.
And which had changed society and impacted on everyone's lives, was World War II.
Right.
So that's why I lit upon that period initially. And then I looked around me and saw Clapham. And I happened across a wonderful institution called the South London Hospital for Women and Children, the buildings of which still stand. They're apartment buildings now with a Tesco on the ground floor. And Clapham South.
That big Tesco that's fairly close to the station?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
Do you know Clapham South?
Yeah, well, you know, loosely. I haven't been there for a long time, but I remember I remember the Tescos, yeah. And you know what? It's one of those things, if you don't know, sometimes you don't look up and you don't think about it. And I mean, if you're on Clapham Common, you sort of look around and you admire the buildings in all directions because there's some beautiful buildings off there, the library, you know, all sorts of things, but you don't tend to know much about them. This is where you have the advantage because, of course, you started digging into this and you know the local people, and it's just fascinating to find out these things. And I get that from your book, you know, so I'm getting excited by those kind of things that crop up as well.
Yeah. It is. I used to walk to work. I used to use that tube to work, to go to work every day. And I walked past the old hospital buildings and knew they were there, didn't really know very much about them. And then happened across an article done in the local Clapham Society newsletter by one of the people who lived in Clapham. And thought, well, this is fascinating. And I looked into it more and more. And I discovered that this was a woman-only institution. It was totally female. It was set up in 1913 by two remarkable ladies, who I can tell you about if you'd like, though I do tend to wax on about these people. a lady called Maud Chadburn, who hailed originally from Middlesbrough, though her family had moved to Kent by the time she was left school. She was the daughter of a Congregationalist minister, who, when she told him of her desire to be a doctor, denounced her from his pulpit and said that he would rather see his daughter dead than become a doctor. So that was the sort of opposition that she
it does faced. Show you the kind of attitude the two women had to put up with. I mean, that's the more remarkable thing, that they not only established an institution that's incredibly rare, but also against the background, you can only imagine the kind of resistance and opposition there was to it, can't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, her fellow founder, Eleanor Davis Colley, who became the first woman admitted to the Royal College of Surgeons, was more fortunate in that she was the daughter of a surgeon who supported his daughter's design. And the two of them got together. Maud was rather older, and that was a sort of partnership in work and in life that lasted for 25 years. And one of the products of it was the South London Hospital for Women and Children, which was a hospital for women and girls, boys up to the age of seven. Yeah, and was staffed entirely by women. So it was a hospital by for women with services provided by women. And it was the terms of the trust which set it up were so tightly written that during the First World War, when the hospital indeed wanted to take male patients.
Yes, right.
From coming back from France, there had to be an Act of Parliament passed to in order to allow them to do so, because the trust was sewn up quite so tightly. Because the founders knew that one of the ways that their institution could be attacked was slowly by, you know, women being replaced by men. And it remained a woman-only institution until its closure. Again, the terms of the trust were so tightly drawn that even after the Equal Pay Act and all you know, the excellent advances that we made,
yes,
the South London Hospital for Women and Children employed only women.
It is remarkable. And it survived into the 1980s, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I found a lovely lady called Juliet Boyd, Dr. Juliet Boyd, Miss Juliet Boyd, or Mrs., because she was a surgeon, anaesthetist who had worked there in the 70s and 80s. And she was something of a sort of hospital archivist. And she went up into her attic, literally went up into her attic and came down with boxes full of old photographs and leaflets about the hospital. And she knew it all. And I couldn't have written this without her, really, because she enabled me to create my SLH, my South London Hospital. And she read the book, as did others who worked there later, and said, yes, that this was the ethos of this place. And people fought long and hard for it to be kept open. There was when the local health authority closed it on grounds, they said, of cost efficiency, and Juliet's blood would boil when this was mentioned. There was an occupation. I mean, there was a huge outcry, and many of the nurses and former patients occupied the hospital buildings and continued to provide services to women. There is a Facebook page called South London Hospital Occupation 1984-1985, of which I am now an honorary member, of people who took part in that occupation. I mean, it was a huge cause célèbre. I mean, women came from Greenham, women came from abroad, you know, women came to protest, because it wasn't unique. The Elizabeth Garrett Anderson Hospital, which was formerly known as the Free Hospital in Northland.
Yes, right.
Was a woman-only hospital, and there were others in other parts of the world, but it was pretty unique, if you can have such a thing, tautology. But
no, I mean, well, yeah, but you know, two out of all the hospitals that we had in Britain at the time, I mean, that is pretty unique. Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating as well, because the hospital is central to the story. When we talk about characters, we might get into that a little bit, but one of the things is as well that this is on the cusp of the NHS. And so part of the story, particularly involving one of the character's sisters, in fact, kind of illustrates what the system was like before. And it's interesting, in your novel, we don't really know what we're moving into, because it's all very well talking about the National Health Service, but nobody really knows what that's going to look like, do they?
No. No, I mean, the National Health Act is passed during the week in which my story is set, or 10 days in which my story is set. But exactly what form it's going to take had not yet been determined. And there was still an awful lot of debates to be had about that. I mean, I read an awful lot about that period, about, I mean, essentially the Attlee government and the enacting of the Beveridge Report, the recommendations of the Beveridge Report, which was fascinating. And the difficulty which they had in creating this. You know, the BMA was against it. A lot of doctors found it restrictive of their freedoms. Though there is the famous, I spread in quotes, stuff their mouths with gold.
Yes.
Because they were paid so well. But so that whole debate was still going on. And what does a free health service mean? Because, of course, England never got a completely free health service.
No, well,
had prescription charges.
Yes.
Scotland did.
Because dentistry was left out, and I think that's an important part too.
Yeah, well, initially.
Seeing where we are now as well, you know, if we could have a more reliable NHS dentist-wise. But sorry, that's me getting carried away again. No, it is interesting because this is also something you brought up earlier, but I would like to look at it a little bit more. It's this thing about this period after the war, and you mentioned it in the terms of COVID, you know, and you can see sort of it's like a freedom, you know, a release. But there's an aspect particularly for women around this, and it's the autonomy. This was a hospital where only women worked anyway, but women were obviously much more important during the war, brought into the workforce to munitions factories, all sorts of things, you know, to do the jobs that men were traditionally doing. And a lot of people got freedom from that. And a lot of people had money in their pocket that they never had independently before. Well, of course, part of the thing about your characters is they don't want to go back to a world the old way. You know, some people do want to try and force that, don't they? You know, back to the old thing. And these characters just don't want that, do they?
No. And I think that's the other thing. I mean, and it's sort of, this is catnip to a novelist, really, because what you have in South London is a place where you have a society in which women, half the population, have enjoyed responsibilities and freedoms which they would never normally have enjoyed. And they've done it quite well, thank you, and demonstrated what they can do. Mm. Yet suddenly they are all having to go back to where they were before because the men are coming home and they're taking jobs. Indeed, one of my characters tries to get a job as a legal clerk, which is what the job that she's been doing during the war, but essentially is told everywhere she goes, well, no, because the men are coming back and we've got legal clerks from before the war. So that in a societal terms is happening. But at the same time in South London, you have this hospital where that's not happening. I mean, the women are still running things. Mm. That necessarily generates a whole load of tensions. And of course, that's just what novelists look for, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
That sort of tension between different things, that sort of fault line that all the drama happens and one can write about it. So that was, I think, something that just naturally arose out of writing about this period in this place. I hope it works.
It does. I think it certainly does come across in the novel. Yeah,
it's interesting. I was going to add that my former mother-in-law was one of these women who, although she went back to house and hearth and home, would regale anyone who would listen with the stories of her war. She had a good war. You know, she, it was tragic. People were dying, but she had a life that she could never have had during peacetime. And I think that, you know, that happened an awful lot. Mm. And there is a whole generation of women who, for various reasons, had to go back to something that was now second best for them.
Yeah, it's not fulfilling in the way that they wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it does come across in the novel. I want to look at something else, which is the underground. We're going back underground again. Because this is a crucial part of it. It introduces the locked room mystery for a start, but it's also a crucial part of the story. So tell us a little bit about the Clapham shelter and the underground.
Okay. Well, I guess this story starts in Spain, actually.
Right.
It starts in Spain during the Civil War with the British volunteers with the International Brigade.
Right.
Who experienced for the first time the sort of heavy bombing by the Luftwaffe and others in places like Barcelona, Madrid, and most notably Guernica.
Yes.
When they came back to Britain, were very vocal in lobbying for shelters to be built because they, like much of the population, could see which way the wind was blowing and that war was on the horizon.
Mm.
Now, the government failed to take note of them at the time. And so when war was declared and you had the Blitz in 39-40, you had population essentially sheltering in underground stations.
Yes, right.
The London Underground. But they weren't built for that purpose, and many of them weren't deep enough for that. There was an appalling tragedy there were hundreds of people sheltering in Bank Station in the city, and something like 86 people were killed because a bomb was dropped on it.
Yeah.
And the government realised that, of the day, realised that they had to do something about it. And so started to do what the veterans of the Spanish Civil War had suggested they do in the first place, which was to dig some very deep shelters. And these were dug all over London. Mm. There were one, two, three, four in South London, and I think slightly more in North London. And they weren't dug in time for the Blitz, but they came into their own during the V2 rocket raids.
Yes, right. Yes. So at the end of the war, or towards the end of the war, yeah. Mm.
That's right. So many of them have now fallen into disuse. Some of them have been repurposed. And there are three in Clapham. There's one at Clapham South, one at Clapham Common, and one at the top of Balham Hill.
One of the interesting things is you mentioned that the entrance to the one in Clapham South is pretty close to the station.
Yeah.
So I would have gone through that station, you know, and walked past it without realizing. And it is this fascinating history that's hidden underneath.
Yeah, it is. It is. And you can see it. You walk out of the station and there it is, just at sort of about 100 yards away, unlovely and unloved concrete pillbox building, covered in graffiti and, you know, almost overgrown now. But that's the entrance to the Clapham South deep shelter.
Yeah, I now know what it is.
And that you now know what it is. And interesting, the London Transport Museum is actually carrying the book for sale.
Right.
Because they do tours called Hidden London Tours.
Yes, right.
One of the places they go is to the deep shelters at Clapham South. They do
interesting.
Sort of walk down there. It is. You've got to be pretty fit, though. There was something like
two. Oh, yeah, right.
Up and down, because the lifts don't work anymore.
But not for the faint-hearted, then?
No.
It's interesting, you know, because that's all. There's this kind of research, which is about talking to people, and it's about reading the historical records and books, you know, and what you can on it. But there's another thing I think is really interesting, and I think it comes across in your writing as well, is this cultural kind of research, in a sense that do you like reading and watching films from the time, I suppose, in a sense, because that gives you another picture of the time, doesn't it? It helps to build up that picture of the characters you then write about.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm sure lots of writers who talk to you, especially those who write historical novels, will have mentioned talking pictures TV, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, I mean, that is a wonderful resource for anyone who's writing a period piece post-war. Watch those old black and white movies. I mean, you know, they might not be of huge dramatic or literary worth in themselves, or even cinematic worth, but you know, they'll tell you what the inside of a working class home in South London looked like, or a Park Lane mansion. You know, you can pick up so much from those old movies, and I have movies in the books, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the characters go to see A Matter of Life and Death, which was the Royal Premier film in 1946 Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger.
Yeah, and still I think remains one of those favourite films, certainly for people of, let's say, an older generation anyway. So,
yes.
And I saw you mention the other day Green for Danger, which I absolutely love. You know, I know it's a romantic film. I know it has its faults, but it's just one of those films that I just love. And Alistair Sim is so good anyway.
Oh, yes. Brilliant. Gubrious Inspector Cockerel.
Yes.
And it has that wonderful voiceover at the beginning when he's typing up his report. And he said, you know, and the postman was riding up the hill. He was the first to die.
Yes. it's jolly, and it just stumbles into, oh, and he was the first to die. Yes.
Yes.
No, it's just brilliant. But anyway, moving on slightly, going back to the characters. Two main characters, in fact, I want to talk about, Faye and Ellie, because they're the team in this. You know, they're the women who become the detectives, and this is partly related to what we said about, you know, not wanting to go back to what you do, in a sense, or did before in the war. But tell us a little bit about, I suppose you've mentioned the hospital, So you've got the hospital and we've got the tunnels. And how does this sort of become an idea about a murder stroke missing persons mystery? And then where do the characters, those two characters, kind of fit into it so that you have that sort of detective force to take it forward, if you like?
I think creating the characters was, okay, let me step back from that and answer the question in a more general way. I think I knew what I wanted to write about in terms of themes of the book,
right,
in terms of capturing a society which was changing and would change and would create that society, the welfare state, which, in which I grew up and many people grew up, and which is today slowly being, well, indeed has been in many respects, dismantled. In order to do that, I would have to do certain things. I think the happenstance of the hospital being on my doorstep and finding out about its history fed into that. It allowed me to talk about the NHS. It allowed me to show an institution which was battling against the establishment in that it was radical and unusual. And I needed characters that would do similar sort of things. So I wanted a working class character, a South London girl who had worked her way up, left school, had no qualifications, and was beginning to flex her her own muscle when it came to determining what her life should be like. And I also wanted, as a sort of, that's Faye, and I wanted as a foil to her a character that came from a very privileged background, highly educated one.
Yes. That,
not to university level, because women by and large did not go to university, even privileged ones at that time. And each educate the others, if you like. But I hope in so doing, they educate the reader a little bit as well in terms of, you know, what the society was like at the time.
It is interesting because there's a nice contrast between the two. As you mentioned, there's a class issue there. But at the same time, then we find out there are a lot of similarities, and that goes to the way women are treated, you know, regardless of their class as well. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, and a real double standard. I mean, there's a genuine double standard in the world that men are, you know, can come back and men can do certain things and do what they want, in fact, almost. And women, you know, you're bound by these strictures. And if you step outside them, you become anathema as far as the mainstream of society is concerned. It's bizarre.
Well, and I think that, I mean, I tried to capture that in the treatment of Ellie's former fiancé.
Yes, right.
Who simply cannot accept that Ellie rejects him, and you know, still thinks he has the right to determine what she should do.
No, it definitely came across that he felt that Ellie would be a possession.
Yes.
You know, it's like something you collect. You collect a job, you collect a wife, you know, and you just, and of course she's not, after the war, that it just doesn't work that way for her. She can't see that kind of future.
No, absolutely. But I mean, that was how, I mean, you know, women didn't have their own property. Women couldn't open a bank account without a male sponsor. I think it comes across, I think, quite strongly to younger women who read it. I mean,
I bet.
Hoback Books, who are the publishers, have a sort of research reading team, and they've been feeding back to me what people have been saying on reading the advanced reader copies, and you know, some of the younger ones simply can't believe that this was how women were treated. Others, and there was a lovely lady who's, I don't know her name, but she'd written to them, please tell Julie she's quite right. My mother used to tell me stories about the war and what happened afterwards. And I had an auntie who worked in a munitions factory who earned her own money for the first time in her life. And the men didn't like it. Vehemence in this
thing.
She to me. So, you know, I think it's something that everyone knows intellectually, but perhaps doesn't get engaged with in a real sense.
I think you're right. I think, and especially, I suppose, maybe even coming from a male perspective, it's all very well thinking you know these things. I've read it in the history books, you know, but actually seeing what it is for an individual is a different thing altogether. And having somebody who's actually experienced explain it to you is something different again. But I think one of the really good things about historical fiction is, in a sense, I mean, it was written by middle-aged white guys. you know, with a certain European kind of background. So it's really great to be able to engage and you know, readdress that. I know it's fiction, so, you know, you're not writing history, but at the same time, you are engaging with that sort of narrow interpretation of history and saying, hey, there's a bigger picture out there.
I think that that's right. And I mean, one of the things that I was very aware of, and actually I was shocked by, was that in doing my research about the hospital, if I hadn't come across Juliet and her box of tricks in her attic, I would not have been able to find out about it. There is there's no biography of the hospital. There's no history book about the hospital. There are no biographies of Maud Chadburn or Eleanor Davis Colley. Nothing, absolutely nothing, which I just think is a scandal.
Yeah. It is, and it's one of those things, it's sort of surprising, and then when you think about it a bit more, you think, no, it's probably not surprising, is it?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think the hospital as an institution, I mean, it from its inception, it had to fight to survive, and I think that it was still fighting during the period in which I'm writing, and fighting up to the end, you know. And, you know, it was always an institution that was... under threat, if you like. But I think going back to your point about people writing historical fiction who weren't who hadn't used to write that sort of thing, or indeed writing books of any kind, novels of any kind, it's so much better now. I mean, Vasim Khan, for example, has given me a quote for the cover of Midnight Man. And I mean, he's a case in point in that, you know, he's written his Persis Wadia.
Yes, series. Right.
And you've got Abir Mukherjee writing his Windham and Banerjee series, you know. So casting a different light again, onto different parts of history, and indeed imperial history or post-imperial history.
Yeah, none.
Crime books, you know, crime books are the great social commentaries of the day.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. In that, slightly connected to that, then you mentioned about sort of reflecting on modern issues, and these do. For instance, you just said a young woman might read this and not realize what it was like, and then reflect on the way things are. And, you know, although things are a lot better, we're still a long way off. One of the things that struck me, and if I'm wrong, you know, we'll strike it, but I just wondered if Sarah Everard, and we've just had the third anniversary of her murder, was maybe in your mind or a little bit relevant to the idea of the book. I mean,
she was in the mind in that, you can't live here without having that. And I mean, I went out with lots of other people and did the walk across the common, you know, when they were looking for her, and indeed would have gone to the vigil, and then didn't, because the police said they wouldn't allow it. And I thought, well, there's going to be trouble then. And lo, there was, unsurprisingly. Yeah. Instead of, and forgive me, this is a local female rant here, but what would have been a properly stewarded local, predominantly female vigil for a murder victim turned into a political platform for the standard rent-a-mob types who there was trouble, and, you know, people were arrested and so on. But so all that happened within, looking out of my window, 200 yards of where I live. So you can't write about the common without having Sarah Everard in your mind. But oddly enough, what I was most concerned about was that I wouldn't be seen to be linking it to the Sarah Everard case.
Right.
Because it is a murder mystery, and there is a woman who dies, she doesn't die on the common.
No, absolutely. I certainly hope I didn't give the impression.
Oh, no, I'm not suggesting you did, but it was something I was very aware of not wanting to do, because, I mean, apart from anything else, her family is local.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Sarah Everard was in my mind, but for a reason other than perhaps, you know, one would imagine. It was more to avoid the links with real life.
I see. Fair enough.
Rather than.
Yeah. No, that honestly, that makes an awful lot of sense. Of course it does.
Yeah.
One of the things that also struck me about the book, because there are lots of strands of the story, we've mentioned the missing woman, you know, we know about the two women becoming detectives in a sense, or proto-detectives, you know, because essentially they're not happy with the way the police are doing the job and the way people are talking about it. And it's quite clear that they're not putting the energy in they should be putting in. one of the things that was interesting about that, I think, is that this is set in a time just after the war. Now, I don't know if people realize, but crime dramatically shot up during the war. Yeah. People might think that the wartime spirit meant that crime reduced. It didn't, of course, it shot up. Yeah. And I suppose this is a period after the war, and I don't want to give anything away, where we would still have a higher crime rate. Mm. And yes, gangsters and so on, you know, it was a good time for gangs during the war. So that also kind of plays into your novel a little bit, because we've got austerity and there's money to be made. Mm. But essentially that's it, isn't it? That during the war, crime actually went up, not down.
It did. And if you think about it, I mean, I know, you know, it's become part of the national myth that, you know, we all pulled together in the war and wasn't life better? Mm. It was dreadful. And in fact, it's just not true. I'm sure that that did happen in certain places. But crime rocketed. If you think about it, there are still burglars and burglaries happening, and yes, a blackout is the perfect cover, you know. And there are other writers have dealt with this. If you look at, have you read Vine Street? You must have read Vine
Street. Yes, of course. Dominolan,
which is wonderful on that period. And others as well. I mean, you know, the crime was leapt during the war, partly because many of the policemen were off fighting. The police was largely staffed by reservists and retired policemen.
Yeah, policemen brought back.
As in my book, indeed.
Yes.
And they didn't have enough resources. Post-war, what this meant was they had to go on a massive recruitment drive and look for people to become police who perhaps they wouldn't have looked at before. The Metropolitan Police particularly were absolutely lambasted for their failure to solve crimes. And indeed, immediately post-war, you have the creation of what was called the Ghost Squad. I don't know whether you've come across them.
Right, yes.
Yeah, which was a Scotland Yard. It wasn't a formal squad, although they were funded as such. A squad that was set up deliberately to countermand the gangs and the crime wave attaching to gangs. And that was a real team that was created, and might give you a clue to something of what happens in my second book.
It might. I see. Right. Okay. I think we've said as much as we should say, though. I think that we've indicated that there are other themes in the book, let's say, or there are other storylines that run alongside what goes on and before everything coalesces, let's say. You mentioned earlier that the hospital's still there. Is it fairly easy walking around Clapham to sort of imagine the way it was at that time? Because you've still got a lot of the old housing there, but I'd imagine, well, I know what the high street was like. I mean, you know, it was changing by the minute almost. It seemed every time you come out of the tube station, there was a different shop or a different bar opening or something going on, you know, so.
It still does. It still does today.
Right.
The 2-year rent limit, you know, these new places have cheap rents for 2 years and then they move out because they can't continue and because landlords hike the rents. But no, it is. I mean, I've lived here for 30 years, so it's sort of easier for me because I can remember how it was 30 years ago.
Right.
Mm. And when many of the buildings would have been in place, but some of them still are. So, for example, my characters, as we mentioned earlier, go to the cinema, and the cinema is the Odeon on Balham Hill, and that's still there.
Right.
It's a majestic wine warehouse.
Mm.
Other wine warehouses are available, et cetera, et cetera. but it's still, the building still exists. Westbury Court, which is where two of the characters live, which is the apartment block above Clapham South Underground Station, still exists.
Yes.
It's largely in private ownership now, but some of it isn't. Some of it's still council owned. That was the sort of whole, sell off council houses, revolution in the 80s. But the building there is still there. It's still an apartment block above the tube station. You've still got the buildings of the hospital. They're still there. And, of course, the deep shelters and the underground station. So a lot of that area around Clapham South and the Victorian housing, because so much of South London, as I know you appreciate,
streets,
that ribbons of development of Victorian pattern-built houses, And of course, Faye, one of my main characters, and her family lives in one of them in Sugden Road, as it happens, on the other side of the common. But there we go. And Sugden Road is still there. The road system's all the same.
No, I just think it is interesting because I think people will kind of get the impression that London changes. And of course, it does all the time. And it's so much. But at the same time, it's surprising how much actually stays the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's perhaps not quite like walking around Hereth or somewhere like that, you know, where you see certain things, but it does retain its certain character. So this is the first, actually, of three.
Yeah.
So I assume it will be, you will stick with that trilogy idea. Is that the,
Well, yeah, I found I've sort of, I didn't start out this thinking this, but I found books in threes. So there were three in the Whitehall trilogy, although there could indeed be a number four.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a natural development to write three in the Clapham books, three of the Clapham's books, 1946, 1948, and 1951. So that period when the welfare state is being created and set up. Ending with the Festival of Britain in the third book, by which time some of the changes which began in the first book in 46 have crystallised or solidified into a form that we might recognise now, but which at the time was you know still nebulous and in
yeah very much so.
Those are the three books.
That's interesting. So we know when they're set. And I did wonder what the gap might be between the books. So
yeah.
Okay. Then one last question. How about a recommendation? And I don't mind if it's a film or a book, and I don't mind if it's something you read recently or something, you know, a classic as far as you're concerned.
Right. Oh, heavens. Right. Okay. Well, I mean, we've mentioned Green for Danger, which is also one of my favorite films. We've also mentioned Vine Street, Dominic Nolan, which I think is a much overlooked book. And I thought was a wonderful book about love.
It is a brilliant book.
Yeah, actually, you know, and how that didn't win prizes, I really don't know, because I thought it was excellent. What have I been reading recently? Well, I've been reading for my column, actually. So I've been reading because you also mentioned the dreadful weather we've had here. So I've been looking for novels that come out this spring that are set somewhere where the weather is brighter.
Ah, okay.
and I've happened across three of them. One is out now. It's called Death Flight by Sarah Saltoun.
The Argentinian book, yeah.
The Argentinian book. Another is a book that is not yet out but comes out soon, which is Bonjour Sophie by Elizabeth Buchan.
Right.
Sort of coming-of-age drama set in Sussex and in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And again, bound up with events of World War II. And the third is Heidi Amsink's Back from the Dead, which is the third of her Jensen books set in Copenhagen. So all of which I recommend in my column, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading. So there you go. Three new books out now.
Absolutely. I it's not out yet, but I have interviewed Heidi Amsink about that book for a Q&A, so that's going to go out later. But No, I will make sure those are in the program notes so people can see them and get a chance to look them up if they want to. And again, I highly endorse Green for Danger, so I hope that people do get a chance. I think it's a golden age of cinema anyway. So
so do I. It's wonderful. I
absolutely think people should look into that. And Julie, that's been brilliant. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. I've talked far too much.
Well, that's what this show is for, so it's okay, I promise. Yeah, we are a talk show, so that's definitely allowed. Thank you very much to Julie Anderson for a fascinating chat about The Midnight Man. The Midnight Man is available in paperback and ebook from Hoback Books, published on the 30th of April. And you should be able to get it through all reputable book outlets. If you want to order it from us, you can click the link on the program notes, and that'll take you direct to the publisher. And with indies, it's always better if you can order direct. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and subscribe with your favorite podcast provider. I will, of course, be back with another interview very shortly. But in the meantime, bye for now, and thank you very much for listening.